This was recorded in Herschel Tribble's workshop on Hatter Creek, Princeton, in July 1973. Herschel was born in 1896. His parents were among the first settlers in the Princeton area. They separated when Herschel was young, and he was raised by his mother. Herschel worked as a scaler and clerk for Potlatch Forest in the Bowville area for many years. Early times around Princeton, centering on his parents, and logging work are main topics of this first conversation with Herschel. The second side was recorded after lunch.
Well, the first thing I wondered was what you heard about things that your father did before you were born. I mean, before you were around.
Well, he was a miner for a long time. He mined in the Hoodoo District there in tributaries of along Camas Creek. We did both plaster and quartz mining, and of course on a small scale. And he had an arrasto wheel there that he ground out little quartz with for sampling such as that, and that wasn't far up the creek, only about a mile and a half, 2 miles up from the mouth of Camas Creek, and around in there in the Gold Hill country in Rainies, he did quite a little mining, and he also logged in the early day here at Princeton with oxen, and logged to Princeton with oxen, and he owned a large amount of property around here. Was best off man financially of anybody, although he owed it quite a lot in 93. Why, he went broke, and everything closed up. He couldn't get money to or anything else, and he went broke and lost it about all. But he kept horses. He had quite a lot of these here little Indian ponies and such as that. They didn't have much value, but he had quite a lot of experiences, I think, in the mining and such as that. And then he finally, in his latter days, he went over around Gifford and raised beans. He'd rent land there and run about 40 acres of beans and harvest them. He had quite a lot of trouble with them because the weather so many times, you know, would destroy them for him or damage them badly. Keep them in sheds, he couldn't get them dry enough to thrash. And he worked at that pretty much until he was retirement age, till he had to quit it, and then he moved to Moscow and lived there the last few years of his life.
But, do you know how he came to own so much land? How he started getting land?
Well, he came in and logged and worked hard. He was a hard worker all his life, and he worked hard, and he speculated. That's how he come to get the land. That's also how he lost it, because he would owe on it then. He was keeping up things, and he would owe everything he bought. Why, he'd owe someone. When he seen a chance to buy some real cheap, why, maybe he got a little hoggish, I guess, and he'd buy more land. And then when the hard time struck, why, there was no work, there was no money, and he couldn't make payments on them, see, on the thing that he owed. And he couldn't even sell part of it to save the rest of it. So it's kind of a rough time they had those days.
Did you ever hear about what it was like before they made there be a town here, how it actually got settled up? It seems like your father had something to do with it if he owned quite a bit of land around here.
Well, yes, but there was nobody lived on any of this land hardly at that time. See, there was it was just in the raw or in the primitive state very near. The Indians had come in, you know, and dig camas on this meadowlands there. Just timothy, it seemed a natural timothy grew on those. And this camas was real thick in there. They come in, there'd be several outfits of Indians. I can remember those myself quite well. Mm-hmm. They used to camp there just south of Princeton, 300 yards, put up their teepees and dig this camas. I guess they'd hammer it out, make bread out of it, I guess. That's what I always heard. I never stuck around eating it.
So they were still coming when you were a little boy?
Oh, yes. My mother was still afraid of them. Now, the wars was over. My father, he had taken part in some of the Indian wars, but while the wars was over and all that, but, you know, even today we got outlaws and everything. Of course, the Indians didn't actually suspicion them, or if anything was did, why, it was destroyed or anything, they'd lay it on the Indians, and I guess the Indians had laid on the white men. The women didn't feel too happy to be left alone or anything. The men usually, my father tried to never leave my mother alone. She was a real good horseman. She got through it one time and drug her foot in the stirrup for quite a ways. And her health, she had very bad health, and she had many operations during her lifetime. And she always thought that it all dated back to this injury from being drugged with a horse. I don't know, that was a supposition, I don't know.
Was that when she was a child?
No, that was when her and my father was living together. She married my father. She rode a horse that my father forbid her to ride, see. And he didn't figure it was safe for her, and he forbid her to ride it. And one day he was gone. Why, she was quite a horse woman, and she felt as though she could ride it, and so she got on it, and it throwed her, and she didn't get one foot out of the stirrup, see.
Do you know what kind of injuries she got?
No, I don't know. Perhaps some internal injuries, because she had several operations. Of course, one operation or two, she was for gallstones. I don't think that ever had anything to do with that, maybe, but I really don't know too much about that. But even back to my memories, there was no settlement beyond about a mile south of Princeton, was about as far as the settlement reached, and until the homesteaders come in. And of course, my folks, a lot of them took up homesteads in this country. And that was, of course, before my time. But when I can remember back to where these old homestead cabins were real good. I used to like to go in there with the kids and look around, you know, and they generally had wood rats in there we could shoot and things. They took over after the people with them.
But you're saying that your father was here before the homesteaders came in.
I think he was. Because quite a lot of my people homesteaded. I had an uncle that homesteaded the very place I live on here. He homesteaded the Miles Trip here. I used to own, my brother and I owned a half a mile right in the middle of it. There was 140 on the south end and the north end that we didn't have. And we had the middle 80 out of this 160 he homesteaded. And so I'm quite sure that my father must have been here before the homestead, that is. But as far as any business or people living outside of that, they just lived on what they had to do, you know, to prove up.
Do you think he actually made a living mining when he was doing it?
Oh, yes. He never made anything big. And nobody, I never knew of anybody getting rich out of it. Yet I guess there was probably several $1 million taken out of this country altogether, but there was probably hundreds of people mining. But they would get enough, you know, and they'd finally get out of there. They were still getting gold when they quit mining. But they'd pan out maybe about $2 a day. Some of them, a few of them could, but... when wages got up and things where they couldn't live at that, why, then they began to put mining. And another thing, then there began to be farms appear along the Pouce River, and these farmers objected to placer mining. They throwed silt down from the mines, you know. Some was hydraulic mining, some was just plain digging and panning, using cradles. I had an old cradle out in the barn for years that my father made and had, and dolls. I still have two gold pans. And, they couldn't pay afford to pay these farmers' damage, you see, for what little there was. And
well, I heard that that your father, maybe this may be wrong, but I heard that he was mining. Where was he mining?
Well, he mined mostly on Camas Creek. Between here and Harvard.
Right. I'd heard that he had taken over some of the water that Emmett Ott's father couldn't use because he'd been flooding out Jim Cochran's land.
Yeah, well, that happened. Jim Cochran's land was flooded with water.
He was threatening a suit.
And he lives right there, you see, lived right there on Camas Creek, practically, in the flat lands there. And he was one of the ones that was causing trouble with the miners. And the miners, of course, they thought they should be able to mine, and the farmers, they didn't want the silt down on their meadows, and so they kind of closed the miners out pretty much. They'd had to put up bonds, you know, and they couldn't afford to do it for what little they were getting out of it. And then it played out, it was slow, but you know, later years, a good many years later, in fact, not too awful long, they put in a dredge in this same country up in here where the miners was, because that was mostly a little further up on the Palouse. But they put in a dredge there and took out a lot of gold there.
Do you know how your father got his claim?
Well, I don't know for sure now. I don't know if he homesteaded or not. I don't think so. My mother homesteaded up at what's now Laird Park, and well, they called it Grizzly Camp then, but now they call it the Grizzle Camp, I guess. I don't know.
No, it's the other way around, right? They call it Grizzle
Camp. Grizzly, yeah, that's what Grizzle it is. Camp. I know they changed the name, but somehow or other. But she had a homestead there when I was 6 years old. And I think we left there just about that time or a little afterwards. It may come down to at least within a quarter of a mile. of Camp Grizzly there. It's just a very little short distance there.
Well, did she have to live on the place to prove it up?
She did have to live there a while, and my oldest brother was made a living for her. He worked out, and I stayed there with her when I was a little kid. And then I had a nephew, my sister's boy. He was only, I was six, he was 2 years younger than I was. He was 4 years old. No, I'll take it all back, he's 4 years younger than I was. He was 2 years old. And we stayed there with her.
What was it like in the place? Was it pretty primitive?
Yes, it was real primitive, but there was just a homestead here and there, and the people only stayed on them, I forget what the requirements was, but they had to stay on them so long each year, you know. And we stayed in there, and they could come out to send children to school and for various things, so we didn't have to stay on them a little while, but it was nice back in there. It was cool and shady and mushrooms, great big old mushrooms, half as big as your head. You can't even find any anymore. And in there, and you know, there wasn't too much deer in the early days. I think there was more deer here in the last few years. They're pretty scarce this last year, but than there used to be. You didn't see many deer. You see some playing, a few cougars. I never saw a cougar myself, but my father, I think, killed a cougar or two. And bear, quite a few bear, but I think no more than there is now. But you know, the woods was primitive. Everything was primitive. The streams were pure and clean, you know. They're not polluted like they are now, and they were not molested. You could catch nice trout in any of them streams. It was a lot different.
Were the farms really small?
Well, there actually wasn't any what you'd call farms in those days. They had timothy, the most more natural crop on the flats that they would cut and pasture their stock and things. There was practically no farming did with machinery. Of course, machinery, they used horses those days, but they'd farm a little bit maybe, and they'd have gardens and things, but there was nobody living on it, just except one once in a while along the river in the flat grounds, you know.
Are you talking now about when you were just a little boy?
Yes, I am. Well, we moved around quite a little. See, I lived in Plouse for a while. I went my first term of school in Plouse. And that was, I don't know, I didn't go to start till I was about seven. There's an old log cabin that has been down for many, many years. Very few people even know that they ever existed there anymore. Just you went in town. But at that time, there was only two or three automobiles as far back as I remember, about two, I think, in Plouse. Around that country, and I think maybe 3 around Moscow. And one fellow there by the name of Half-Eyed, it was a blacksmith. He wasn't a Negro, but he was sure black. And he'd give kids all rides on the motorcycle of the evening. Nice old guy. But I wouldn't ride on that. I was always afraid of one. I never would ride on a motorcycle.
What was Palouse like then?
Well, it was real lively. Before my day, there was one, at one time, there was supposed to have been 13 saloons in that little town of Palouse. They had a mill. Now, if you take the to Pullman or anything, you leave town and go with the rays there on the North Hill, we used to call it, and down on the river, on the Palouse River, and there's a mill set right in there where the railroad tracks and the highway goes now. And that was one thing that kept Palouse up. And then they had a row of houses uptown there they called the Mill Row. The houses all practically like built for the crews. They had quite a number of churches there. They had a street they called Church Street. I don't know, there must have been five or six different churches all along that street. Pretty near all the churches in Palouse was on that one street. And in town there, I remember a fellow by the name of McLemy running a drugstore for many years. He'd been dead for a long time now. And Corn running a hardware, his boy still runs it.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew him quite well and knew the boy quite well. But then they had the schools. Now, when I went there, they had the one school. They had this old school I said I first went to. They had a school on the North Hill and one on the South Hill. And I went to almost every room in all the three of those schools. But we moved around so much. I was there when they put in this WIM Railroad. They put in that cement wall there at Palouse in 1906. And as kids was playing around, they had them old cans, you know, and the powder cans, black powder cans, blasting. And there was generally a spoonful or so of powder left in the bottom of them. And I gathered up them with the kids. Well, I did with a bunch of us kids, and we'd take them out and set a pile of powder we could get out of them, and then light them with a match and watch them flash. And I got the bright idea to take a flame to set it off. And I had a stick there, the fire on, and went out, and I got to blow on this red ember there, getting it down close to the powder. And pretty soon away went the powder, and I thought I'd lost my eyes. I couldn't see for a little bit. It's filled with ashes and dust and singed my eyebrows, and I sure thought I was blind. It didn't really injure me any, but it was a pretty close call.
What do you remember as a kid about the putting in of all this this new work when they put in the railroad and the walls and the mill?
Well, my mother looked at that property. She was in the market. She sold, see this homestead up here, she sold it. And she was looking for a place she wanted to buy. And she looked at the property right exactly where the town potlatch stands. But that was full of little potholes there, you know, and they just all around, all dozers. Now they wouldn't think anything about it, but those days when they worked with horses, well, you didn't see how you could farm it or do anything there with it. And so she decided not to buy it, and she bought a place over north of Potlatch, then about, a couple of miles or so. And later on, it filled it there.
There was nothing at Potlatch then, was there?
Oh, no, absolutely nothing. And then they come in after that, you see, and then bought this up and put in the town and the railroad and everything. That was real early in the day. I don't know what year that was in. But I wouldn't say they were unknown, because when we lived on that place there north of Potlatch, I went to school there, see, so the Potlatch must have been known there, but they come in, they started building the railroad in 1906. But the town of Potlatch, they hadn't established it yet, I'm sure, at that time.
Did a lot of people come in then? When they started the building?
There was quite a lot worked on the railroad, you know. They worked here and there. They put crews in one place and some more up some other place, you know, so they could have different crews working at the same time, and quite a few come in at that time. And then they bought that land up there with the town high, and they started building the town. See, that was a one-man town. Everything was for many, many years, you know, it just belonged to Potlatch. The bank was put in there just to help the working men that worked at the mill was all it was for. And the store was, they advertised everything to eat and work with. But it was Potlatch store. Everything was there. You couldn't own land. There was house in Potlatch at that time. And so it all belonged to the company. That put a lot of people in there to work, you see, to operate all these things, work in the railroad, they got started. And then, of course, when the railroad was in, there was various other things to do then. The early days there now, there was a pretty busy place there in Plouse at that time with all those saloons. And there was a brewery as you went in. They're just to Plouse from the east side, right on Main Street. There was an old thing that wouldn't be, well, nowadays they wouldn't allow it in 100 miles of civilization, I don't think. And that sure perfumed the town. Good, you smell out the windows right any place in Plouse.
What did it smell like? Did it stink, or did it smell like Olympia now? Or?
Oh, it smelled, I guess, like... Well, of course, they go through a brewery now, then there's not a bad odor in them at all now. But I don't know, hardly it's a fermenting, you see, the brew there, and then that went in large amounts, you know, that's I think it's open kettles for a while, I think, and there's a lot of perfume goes off from those.
So Princeton was just tiny compared to Palouse.
Oh, yes, Princeton was just tiny. Actually, Princeton started there west on what they call Hampton. That was the original Princeton, I think. It was, that's where the store and post office was. I can remember back to that store and post office.
Do you know
there.
Why it moved?
I don't exactly know. I tell you, yes, I think maybe I do. I think that when the Potlatch came in, I think they put the depot, that was up away from on the hill from the railroad track, and Princeton was right on the level, and they would be, and they put the depot there, see. And there's people lived around, too, like my father over there logging, there's other people worked, you know, logged too and things, but there was no town. I don't know if there's even a store there at this time. That was what I'm talking about now is when I was a little too young, see. I just can remember being up there. I can remember I had the scarlet fever when I was 4 years older and was quarantined for a long time and I couldn't die with it. But and a man by the name of Steiner who ran the store and post office. And my grandfather, he had a house there and he had a dance hall there. They used to go to that, have all the entertainment, their dances at this old dance hall. I remember he got the leaning and he had three poles on the west side. It was leaning toward the west. Okay, and he had three big poles, looked like telephone poles up there for braces to keep upsetting. It was getting so it wasn't. I probably wasn't too strong built to start, I don't know.
Now, how about how Princeton got its name?
It was named after a horse my mother had. They tried to, and I was going to name it after her, and her name was Coronetti, and they decided to name the town Cora. And they sent this in to wherever they send to get it registered, I don't know, county seat or capital. And they couldn't name it that because there was already a Cora in Idaho. And so then they decided to name it after a horse by the name of Prince. I believe it was a pinto. It was a spotted pony, some kind of my mother's. And they decided to name the town after this spotted horse, and there was also a town by the name of Prince. So they called it named Princeton. That's how they got out of it. So it was actually named after a horse that my mother had.
Do you know anything about what the Depression did in 1893 to this country?
Well, people didn't have any money, actually. But what it did, they couldn't get any money then. They just tightened down, they couldn't get any money. And then there's some of these land companies come in. I would hate to name them. In the background of my mind, there was a...
I heard there was one called Hypothec or something.
Hypothec. Pronounced Hypothec, yes. That's one of the outfits that had it. And then there was a fellow around here by the name of Codd, Bill Codd, that bought up these homesteads, timber. My mother, I think, sold him, I believe it was. And he bought up all this timber then ahead of time. And I believe the Potlatch, I'm not sure about this now, I believe the Potlatch bought some of this stuff from some of the other companies, from some of the smaller companies, I don't know. But some of these big outfits, you see, they had mortgages on all this. And so when times got rough, why, they called in foreclosed, see, and... Because I guess they was mostly after the property rather than the money. And the fellas that owed them, why, couldn't pay it. That's what wrecked my father, and I guess it wrecked other people, and they had to start all over again. But they had no money to pay, you see. They had quite a lot of time on them normally, on payments. But they just closed down, and they had to have it right then, or else.
Do you think that many people left at that time and when they
no,
got closed down?
No, I don't
down?
Think they left. I don't think they left at all. Those people was in here, most of them, I think, liked the country and everything. It was a new country, and they didn't have any money to go anyplace else. They didn't have any place else to go, really, and where they could better themselves. I don't think hardly anybody left here at that time.
How do you think they started to come out of it?
Well, I think things pretty soon begin to develop a little more. They begin to do anything they could. Maybe a little mill, or somebody did have a little private property left or something, and saw a little lumber for somebody. They traded back and forth, mostly without money. Some fellow, if he wanted lumber, maybe trade somebody a cow or some rutabagas or lettuce or something else. Started to barter and trade around for things, you know, and everybody helped one another. If anybody burned out or had hard luck, everybody just grabbed the tools and everything, and they went right over there and they built him a new house. Of course, they'd make him out of logs, you know, grab the logs, they didn't cost them anything, and start him up again that way, I mean, in a home. And they lived on almost nothing. They'd raise, have cows, you know, and a few cows, and have milk and butter and things that way. And then they'd have pigs, you know, they'd raise their own lard and pork and things that way. They'd gradually begin to get a little on the farming idea. What little they could, and different things, trade work. They just worked without money almost.
What would they do if they didn't have any land, though? I mean, if they
lost it. Well, once in a while, they'd find somebody big enough that needed help or something that would maybe would give them a little bit of money, just a tiny bit, you know, for things they had to have. Maybe he'd pay them and something. They was that hard up. Why they'd need things too, and they'd maybe. Divide up land with him or something to get him to work. They didn't have enough to pay him. Any way to get by those days.
Did you ever hear anything from your father about that times?
No, I didn't. I didn't. My mother, I don't know, and father, my mother didn't, after she left my father, she didn't want me to have anything to do with him or see him or anything, which was all wrong, but she thought that he would want to get me back, kidnap me or something. He probably didn't even want me, but no, he was a nice guy, really nice. After I did get acquainted, I didn't really get acquainted and know who he was until I was almost grown, and I found out that he was a real nice man.
Did you hear anything from her about it, about these times, the Depression?
Not too much. I don't think she paid too much attention to them. She generally fared a little better. I don't mean that she had money, but a woman got along better than a man did those days, and she took up this claim, you know, and she got the real high price on it. She had one, a real nice claim up there. She got $2,300, which was a lot of money at that time. She could have got a lot more money than that if she'd held off, but she got that, and then she bought this place I spoke about out at north of Potlatch, and then I don't know if she sold that, and she got an idea about going up west to Spokane, bought 5 acres up there. I went to school one term there, and she was going to make it on a little truck farm, which was out of the question. She couldn't make anything. Everybody else around Spokane was trying to make a living that way, so she soon got out of there, and then she kept house for my grandfather. They're in Bluse a while, and I took care of him until he died there the last years of his life. That's how I come to go to school in Bluse while we were there. I remember a little kid when you got a pension from the Civil War of $12 a month. It was pretty hard scraping around, but he had two houses and lots there, and he kept one rented all the time, and he kept bees, and he had orchard, and he kept gardening and everything. And he didn't pay mother anything. It was her father, and she's glad to see her. He just provided the groceries and such. And he might have given her a little bit, you know, for my clothes or hers. I don't know about that, but I think maybe she still had a little bit of money. But it was pretty rough going there. And then that pension, I remember the last I knew, most he ever got was the double of $24 a month.
Well, about your father, do you know any stories about him that can sort of tell what kind of guy he was? All different things that he did and that you heard about?
Well, he was full of fun. Real full of fun. And always joking about everything. And he was a happy-go-lucky guy. He used his politics to joke with a lot. And you'd like me to mention that, what I mentioned the other day when I was seeing you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good
story. Well, yeah, a few little incidents. One time, he and some of the others, during the mining, someone was killed. I don't know if my father killed or who, but one of them killed a cougar. And up between Princeton and Harvard, kind of on the hillside above the old road there, they propped it up among the rocks and things so it looked like it was alive. And there was some Chinamen working on the mines up there, and come along about scared them to death. They run way out around, and everybody come along for a while. They had a lot of fun out of that, they thought. Probably did. And another little incident I remember, he was always just joking and cutting up all the time, but anyway, a little incident I remember, him and an old fellow, he was a distant relation of ours, but he wasn't very well liked by anybody, including us. But I say us, that was before my time, or not before my brother remembered it, but anyway, he met this old fellow. The old fellow was in a wagon going down the road, and I don't know, they got into some kind of an argument. Could have been political, they were on different sides of the fence, I don't know what it was, but anyway, this old fellow, he had a .22 rifle in the wagon, and he picked this up and pointed at my father and threatened to shoot him. And my father told him, he says, if you ever shoot me with that and I find it out, he says, I'll beat hell out of you. He was that kind of a man, he wasn't afraid of anything. I think I'd have run if it'd been me. I might have been for me. I've used too many of myself and killed too many elk in my time. I know what they can do. But little things, he was always little things that way, you know. And then he had, a nephew of mine, the father kind of liked bees. He usually had a few bees. And he was fooling around these bees. And my nephew, he was afraid of bees, real afraid of them. And the father says, oh, they won't sting you if you just keep back and leave them alone. He said, they won't sting you. So his nephew kept getting a little closer. And father said, well, one of them sting you pretty soon if you get too close. And he kept getting up there, and he thought my father didn't get stung right among them. He could get among them, and pretty soon one stung him. My father says, I told you. He says, I knew that. He says, I knew it. He says, they'll sting a Republican every time. He was a radical Republican. My mother was a radical Democrat, and I didn't know what to be. But he was always pulling jokes about that, and he'd tell anybody if there's Republican, if there's hollering about somebody, they'd say, well, they voted for it, didn't you? He sure made a lot. You'd think that people would want to shoot him, but actually, he was always a joke and did it in fun. You know, he'd get by with it where other people couldn't, probably. But he was awfully well liked. All my folks just thought the world and all of my father.
Was he very political himself? Did he?
He was county commissioner here in Moscow for I don't know how long, but he represented this district for a while, central committeeman, and he didn't take any very big active part or try to run for, I think that's the highest he ever ran. I don't think he cared too much about going up into politics any, but he did think that the Democrats was all right.
How's she going?
Oh, fine.
Now, you guys haven't done a darn thing, I bet you.
What do you mean?
Hey.
We've been sitting here talking. Oh, that's... that doesn't matter.
Sorry.
It doesn't matter. Are you my wife getting on?
Are you about ready to come in and have a wine with us?
Well, we could have a beer first.
We'll come in, have your beer, and then you can have your dinner.
Okay.
Fine.
Okay.
I don't know what we've got in place now, but we sure had a lot of fun.
Okay,
there really wasn't many Chinese around. The three or four of them had a mine that others had passed up along up on Camel's Creek a ways, a mile and a half, 2 miles up from the mouth, and they didn't associate much with other people or vice versa. And they began to get to the head, the miners probably, that these Chinese were making a lot of money, which it's, nobody knows for sure. And so they robbed him and killed him, and nobody ever knew who did it. And those days they didn't try very hard to find out, especially where it was Chinese. And nobody ever knew if they got any money. Lots of people don't think they got any money really out of it. But there wasn't too many foreigners around. Mostly where there were local white people that were mined, different nationalities naturally. But very few foreigners.
What happened to the Chinese?
Well, because they killed those, and I don't know what they did. I don't know if people buried the bodies or what. I really never heard. That was a little before my time, so I just have to know what my father and my older brothers told me about it. But this is on the same creek that my father mined on.
They never had any idea who did it?
No. Not that I know of. Maybe some people did know who did it, but might not have been interested in saying anything or having any part in it. That's the way those things happen lots of times, especially in the early days. You know, there was nobody around near to report it to, and it had to come by horseback to got in there to investigate it. And
do you think it would have been much different if it was white guys that had been killed instead of Chinese?
Yes, I think it would have been some more different, but still there was things come up that I've heard them tell about that I don't remember the incidents or anything where there was murders committed and they paid very little attention to it. If a person in those days, if he just get across the line into Canada, why, that was all there was to it. Nobody tried to follow him any further, and lots of people didn't even do that. They just moved around some other location. And there wasn't much law and order those days.
Do you know any other stories about violence or murders around?
Well, my memory isn't very good. There was a murder committed right here in a little over a quarter of a mile from my place. There's some jealousy, something over a woman, man up further up the line here up the creek. He came down and shot a man off my roof working, but he skedaddled up to Canada, and that was the story anyway, and nobody ever got a hold of him. Nothing ever did about it. And I guess they both wanted to go with the same girl or something that way. I don't know just what the setup was. But personally, I don't know. It was by the time I was old enough to know too much about these things, why the law and order was getting a lot better established. And they began to get more roads and even got the railroad in when I was fairly young. And then, of course, with that came telegraph wires and telephones. And so crime wasn't so easy. And people began to work for companies and get a paycheck rather than mining, and mining didn't any longer pay.
What are some of the different jobs that your mother did? What was it like for a woman making a living?
She was pretty hard up. She kept eating in on her money she had from her timber claim. But she did keep house a little bit. In those days, taking in washing or keep house for somebody or something. Her and I lived at a farm. She kept house and did the housework for a man for a while. And she wasn't able to take in washing. And she worked a little bit at picking fruit and various things. Her and I went up by Spokane when I was a kid, and we picked cherries and strawberries and cucumbers, whatever we could. And things like that. And my mother made an attempt with other parties a time or two to run a restaurant in Spokane, but they failed. She wasn't She was a good cook, but she wasn't a businesswoman when it comes to anything like that. And she didn't have any regular profession, so it was kind of hard for her.
You told me that she ran the mail?
Yes, she did run a mail regular. That was before my time, before my memory. I was real small, or before I was born, I'm not sure. She did run a hack and a team of horses from what is known as Hampton, or part of Princeton now, as a store and post office combination there, and she run a mail and even carried passengers from there up to Grizzle Camp for a while. My sister even took her place a little while when she was sick or something. I don't know just how long, I don't think it's too great of a time, but she did run this mail horse in the days of mud and horses.
Mm-hmm. What about your brother? Your brother who is a cook in the camp. So what sort of jobs did he do?
Well, he never exactly learned a profession. I mean, he never studied one, but he had three professions that he came pretty good at through his lifetime. The one, he was a pretty good butcher. He did the butchering at the town of Bowville for the meat market that supplied all the Potlatch Lumber Company camps and the town of Bowville. At one time, he did all their butchering, and he stayed with that a while. He didn't like it too well, but he worked at anything he could to make a living, him and his wife and little girls lived up there, and I stayed with him and graduated in eighth grade in school there while I was staying with him at Bowville. And then later on, why, he became a cook in the Potlatch camps, and he was cooked for quite a while. Several years he spent cooking, and he gained the name of being a good cook. He was very clean and a cook, and everybody seemed to like him pretty well. But then in later years, when the logging kind of played out, he went to carpenter work. He'd always been pretty handy with tools, and he went to work at building houses and repairing and whatnot, any kind of good. I worked there with him for about 3 years there at carpenter work, and he helped build several houses around this community. And then up at Deary, he built one, and Avon one. And he spent most of his time, the latter years of his life, working at carpenter work until he got too old to work and retired.
What of your sister?
My sister, she married a railroad man. They lived in Spokane for quite a while, and he was in charge of the pumps on the SPNS. And he used to take out the extra gang there to work sometimes. He was a pretty high official in the railroad system, and he kept the pumps in repair all along the line that supplied the trains with water. And they lived there until he was transferred to Portland, and that's where they lived until my sister died. My other brother,
Arvid.
Arvid, between Ellen and I, he worked at first one place thing, then another. He worked at Chico, California for a farmer, grafting and budding on shrubbery and trees for a while. And he worked in the cider yard at Bovo for a while, but he settled down working in one of these supply stations that my brother-in-law was in charge of at up by Sprague, Washington. He supplied the town where he lived in was Lamont, and that's where the supply station was. He operated the pumps and stuff there, and the roiling and various things that they supplied the trains with. And he lived there until his retirement. They moved to Spokane, and he and his wife, and he died in Spokane.
Well, let's talk about your early years in the woods. How did you come to start working in the woods?
Well, I started in, my brother and I, we bought, well, he had, my brother had first had 40 acres of land here on Hatter Creek near Princeton, south of Princeton, and he sold it, and we together bought 80 acres and from the Potlatch Lumber Company and received a contract to log it off. It was their timber, they held the timber, but they gave us a job so much per thousand to log it off. And what we were to do, we were to get it to the river, Pluse River at Princeton, any way that we could, which was usually by what they call go devils, a couple of runners with a bunk across from one end, the log set up on that, and the other end drugged the ground and fastened with chains. And horses, of course, is what we use for power. And so we spent about 3 winters logging this while I was too young to hire out for companies, and then we drove it to Potlatch. It was spring when the high water came up and ice break up and the logs released, so we rolled what was left of them in the river and drove them to Potlatch. And then after that, why, I went to work in the woods, camp up around Bowville, and I worked at anything I could get for a little while there, and they were having trouble. Well, I bucked wood for the old ground line donkeys for a while, and I ran hoisting engine, a loading engine on the donkey for loading cars a little bit, and then I came a vacancy in the a clerk and scaler. One man had to do the clerk and scaling for the whole crew, sometimes 100 men. And they'd been having trouble getting clerks and scalers. They didn't stay. It was a pretty hard job. They kept them so busy. So they gave me the job. I didn't know anything about it, and so several of them helped me out, and I managed to hold it until I learned it. And some nights I'd have to scale all day during the day, and then some nights at the end of the month I'd have to set up maybe 12, 1 o'clock for 2 or 3 nights making out the payroll and writing out the checks. It was very difficult for me until I got onto it. And then finally it got sort of much easier and I could do it. But then eventually they changed the system. At that time when I scaled logs in the woods, all I had to do was just mark them any way that I could tell them. There was no numbering or anything, and just numbered them on the landing. But then they got to put more work on there, and so then they divided the scaling and the clerking, and they'd have a clerk and a scaler in the camp. The clerk would keep the books then, and I didn't like the clerking myself, so I kept getting out of it all I could, and so I took over gradually the scaling, and I scaled the logs. I was a landing scaler, and they kept increasing until finally they had a scaler in the woods for the saws, and a landing scaler, and a scaler on the marine. When they get to paying everybody with $1,000, and I worked at that for several years, and I worked at that until they began to shut down during the winters, and always before they had run steady, but they started in, so they just logged through the summer in good weather, and I worked. I was only get about 3 months, 3-4 months of work a year, and I couldn't make a living for a family at that, and I scaled an old check scaler, and I was scaled the first logs that was hauled by truck to Potlatch, and. So I had to turn that down, and because I couldn't get steady enough work, and then I worked with my brother at carpenter work for about 3 years. And there came an opening for a mail carrier here at Princeton. There's about 18 of us applied, and I took the exams and happened to win it. Was lucky, I guess, and it was only a tri-weekly route at that time, only 3 trips a week, and very little money in it. So little that I built 2 trailer houses in my yard for people to help make a little more money, and then we also ran a few cows and milk, and our kid was getting big enough by that time then to milk cows, and we sold a little cream and one thing and another until the mail route got eventually longer and longer till it got up enough so that I could make a living at it, and I carried mail in for 25 years and till I retired in 1960. Since then I haven't did much work. My health hasn't been good enough to hold down a job, and I don't do any hard work.
But you do a lot of woods crafts work, it seems.
Well, I have a pretty nice little woodworking shop. I have probably one of the best woodworking shops around. Quite a lot of machinery and tools, and I do work a little repair work, and I have some wonderful grandchildren, and they came in put in a top of a bridge new for me, and they put a metal roof on my garage. I have a real large garage, and 3-car size and size for shop, and they put that on for me. I furnished the material, and them and their wives came, and they took wire scratch brushes and scratched the old paint off of my shop and off of my house and repainted it all. They did all these things for nothing. Wouldn't take anything for it, and so I wanted to do something for them. One of the boys wanted me help him make a gun cabinet, but he wasn't busy and didn't get around to it, so I made the gun cabinet for him, and then I started in and I made a gun cabinet for each of the boys. I made one out of just the front, the glass doors, and with the front was some drawers, and everything were made out of white pine. And the next one made one of a knotty white pine in the front, and the last one made out of a bird's eye pine. And they furnished just the material, and I did the work. It was quite a, quite a long, tedious job making them. And I let them do the finishing of the painting and such as that with them. And I made window boxes for the granddaughters and such. And I made a water wheel for my daughter and a windmill for my wife. And so I spend my time, spare time, working shop, things like that.
I want to get back to the scaling in the woods that you started talking about and didn't describe how it was done then when they were first scaling. You know, how was it that you did scale the logs there in the, when you first started?
Yes, well, when I first started, I didn't scale them in the woods for the sawyers. The sawyers worked by the day, and the logs were only scaled once. And that was a little later. I was a little ahead of my story. It was later when they got to chippewaing it that I scaled them for the sawyers, and I only had to just mark them anyway to tell. But at first, they would just scale them on the landing, and then I clerked, which was a very big job because they had 100 men in that camp, and they was coming and going all the time. But later then, as they eased that situation up, but the scaling of the logs, well, of course, they used the, what they call the decimal C. There's several others. There's a Scribner and a Doyle and one thing or another, but they used what they call a decimal C that gives 1/10 of the scale. You have to add a cipher onto it to get the full scale. And you measure the distance inside the bark, one side of a log, the next the other, on an average. You get the average size and figure the length of it in your rule. I'll tell you then for that length, but that size log, the number of board feet is supposed to saw out. And then you have to mark that on cards and carry it in your books and all the way through and add that all up in the month, make out reports for the how much many feet of board feet of logs they get out.
When you say that you could scale it any way, what does that mean?
Average way. Average way. I think probably misunderstood me on that. The average way. You know, sometimes they're round and sometimes they're sort of oval. And if you scale the narrow way at the end of the log, why, it wouldn't be a fair scale. Or if you scale the wide way of it, it wouldn't be. So you take the average diameter, see, of the small end of the log and measure it in inches. And, well, you just look at the scale, it tells you on the rule, see, how much that log will give. You have three or four different columns, it gives you how much if it's a 12-foot log, if it's a 14, a 16, an 18, or a 20. All those figures are on the rule in a row for each one, see.
Well, did this change as time went on, the method of scaling?
No, it didn't. I don't, I believe now, to this day, I believe they still use the same decimal rule. I don't know, of course, the late years, but I think they still use the decimal rule.
How could one guy be expected to scale and clerk at the same time? Scaling seems like a full-time job.
It was a full-time job. That's right, it was. It didn't, it had been easy to scale the logs in the day at that time, quite easily. Because most of their logs were long logs, 32 feet, see. Now, your scale rule doesn't give a 32-foot log, but what you do, you take the 2/16s, figure it 2/16s, and we figure an average gain of 1 inch, so we figure the second log. In most cases, that don't apply to all kinds of timber. In most cases, we'd figure the next inch for that and add the two of them together to find the scale of that 32-foot log. So that is fairly fast, see. A ground line donkey doing their best would put out about 5 or 6 carloads of these logs. And that wasn't too hard for one scaler, but there'd be a donkey up on one spur, that's the railroad track, short railroad track they run up in there, and maybe another off down a mile or two or three in some other place. You had quite a little walking to do on that, and then you had to, you scale them on cards, and then when you got in camp, you had to copy them in books, regular scale books. And then at the end of the month, well, you kept your time, which wasn't bad, hard. At the end of the month, then you had to make out payroll and write out all the checks to these men along with that. Well, I had to do that night, see. It really was too much, and they paid a clerk and scaler by the month, not by the day. So they didn't have any, you didn't get any overtime those days. But
how did you learn how to clerk? How did they guys, well, what did you need to know, and how did they break you in?
Well, that was kind of a strange one. They hadn't been awful short of clerks and scalers, they couldn't have, because the foreman wanted me to take over. They'd been having trouble with clerks. They'd get one broke in there and supposed to be clerks, and they'd quit or something. And they'd had all kinds of trouble, and that was really bad, changing clerks and scalers all the time. So it was getting so hard that nobody wanted to scale for that camp. Well, me, I had no profession of my own, and it was quite a thing for me if I could just hold that job down. And the foreman wanted me to because he knew me real well, and I was a steady worker. And he thought maybe if I had it, why, that I'd keep it. So He gave me a big lingo. He said that I'd never been in the office there, only to buy my tobacco I smoked, and I had never been in there only for that. That's all I knew about office work. And he told me that he used to be a contractor. He had run gangs of men building railroads. But he didn't tell me that he didn't have any education and couldn't hardly sign his own name. He didn't tell me that. He told me he'd help me with the payroll. Then he told me that the auditor in Bowl that would correct my mistakes or get after me if I made them would help me. He'd learn me a lot about handling the clerical work. And the truth of the matter was, the little guy in Bowl, I'll not mention his name, he's a good little guy. He was fine, he wasn't cranky or anything, but he never explained a thing. He just showed me where I made mistakes and told me how it should have been done or what should have been or something. And I didn't learn very much from him. Another man was supposed to show me how to make out the scale reports, and he was pretty good, he helped. But by the time I scaled all day and worked at night, it was just bad. I didn't know if I could possibly handle it or not. But the foreman, he didn't really have the right to hire a clerk and scaler. That come under the superintendent at that time, and he told me he thought that if I could make it, and he talked to the superintendent, he could get him to keep me, maybe, and they said unless they already had somebody hired. So it turned out they didn't already have somebody hired, and the superintendent agreed that I could stay. And so I stayed, and the work gradually got easier for me all the time as I learned. I was always pretty good in arithmetic, and on making reports and adding payrolls and things, I was pretty fast at it, and it didn't bother me very much after I had a little practice. I made quite a few mistakes at first, but I'd get so eventually that I'd hardly make a mistake and carried 30 names on each sheet of the payroll, and maybe they'd change rates of pay by the hour, you know, two or three times on that, and you'd have to figure out how many hours at this rate and how many hours at the other rate. Then they charged them $1 a month hospital ticket. Then they had the one again they called a little store there that I had operated to, where they sold stockings and shirts and pants and sold pretty much everything that they used in camp, and charge that up to them and keep it. And then if there's any deductions for contributions for things, why, I keep that all up and deduct it. But it wasn't too bad there. And finally, as the camp got so and they required more, they began to have the woods, the timber sawed by the thousand. Gyp one, lots of times they call it, and there had to be a scaler in the woods. And at first I took on some of that, and I just marked the logs any way I could, just to show that they were scaled. That's all I had to do. Now that was a big advantage, because sometimes they fall a tree up on a steep hill and it slides clear to the bottom. And if you have to climb that mountain just to put a number on that stump after you scaled it, that's quite a deal, see. And so it went on that way for quite a while, and then all at once we gets orders that we had to number those logs so we could be checked on. And so then I'd have to number the tree, and then I'd have to go up and number the stump. And that caused a lot more work and trouble. And I come to find out the reason for this, that up at Elk River, there'd been two young scalers up there. There's supposed to be 6,000 feet of logs in the woods, and when they got them in, there was only 3,000. The sawyers had been paying them a little bit to slip them some extra scale. So that punished the rest of us. All they did was fire them two boys, but the rest of us stayed there. We had to pay for it, because then we had to start numbering ours and climbing the mountain to put the numbers on.
So that's what was the difference if you numbered it up the mountain or if you numbered it down in the landing?
Well, they had to correspond. You number the tree down then, and they go up and give the stump the same number to show that it come from that stump, see. But
who
it
checked?
Began, how's that?
Who checked?
Oh, they had regular check tailors. A fellow by the name of Jack Donovan checked most of the time I was there, and then there was a government man, Ed Kilty. He was a real nice fellow. I was scared to death the first time he checked on me. I just thought, boy, I didn't know much about it, and I was trying to learn. And I was just there shivering while I was waiting for him to check, and he came back, and he didn't say much. I told him, I'd be glad to learn anything you can. I said, I don't know anything about this. Well, he says, you've done all right, he said. He went out real nice. He says, there's a log or two out there. He says, I just wondered, he says, what you'd give that. He says, now, he says, sometimes opinions vary. You can't know two men to be just alike on them. And maybe, look at one of them and say, well, I think that's about what I done. Another one, he said, I'd give that a little bit more than you did, or I'd give it a little less than you did, or something. See, and he'd say, well, now, then you may be just near right as I am. And, he was just one of the nicest guys that I ever met. And he was always that way, just like that, and checking. He'd tell you so nice that you didn't feel like you'd been reprimanded at all for it, you know. And I learned to really like him. And Donovan was a nice fella, too. He was the regular check man. But he'd come out, I don't know how to tell you how often, ever 10 days maybe or so. He made the rounds of the camps, you see. But he and I, we always got along good. They're the ones that checked you. They was really our boss when they were on the scaling. But on the clerical work, why, the auditor really at the The town was sort of boss over that. But then, finally, when they got the soldiers working by the thousand there, Jippo, what they called it, contract, however you want to, then they had to have a special scaler for scaling the woods. They weren't too particular with that. It didn't have to match the landing scale, but they wanted to get a little accurate. They didn't deduct for rot or anything to start with there, and then later on they did. But as they began to put more and more on, well, it took more scalers. So they had a scaler in the woods, and then I was a landing scaler. My scale went back east to the warehouse, which led back to Minnesota, the results of it, the totals of it. And then they had one on the Marion to scale on to pay the Marion crew with a thousand. With three scalers, we're almost wearing the end of the logs off, getting the scale time was all done, I think. But I worked at the scaling then for quite a number of years. They went through some cycles when I first went to camp. No horses. They had what they call a ground donkey. They'd go out, though, sometimes half a mile with them lions, maybe longer, but that was considered a pretty long haul, half a mile. Get over, maybe 3,000 feet, they'd be a little over half a mile, but they brought in the logs and the whole tree with those to the landing, and then they'd have landing sawyers. This donkey would haul that in, you see, the steam donkey. And they'd have landing sawyers, and there's another little engine on that operated the same boiler as the big donkey did on that same platform. And they would load. There'd be the wire line would go up through a block on a pole, and go down in a crotch in it with a hook on each end of this crotch. And a man would take charge of each hook, and when each one would stick the hook in the end of the log, the same log, see, you know what I mean? In one end, the other man would stick his in the others, and then the hoisting engine would hoist this end of this log up, and as it swung high enough to swing across the car, they'd drop it in the notches on the car. That's how they loaded. And these hooks had ropes in them that the men hang on to them, so all they had to do was jerk them and pull the hooks right back to them. And that's the way they loaded. And that's the way it was operated when I first went to camp. But then they brought in what they called the high lines, and those they had to slice down, slice a wide strip for these high lines. The others they didn't. And they slash quite a wide strip because they'd knock the trees down on tougher if they didn't. And they'd bring them in on that, dangling in the air. Now, a lot of people didn't know them. Worked a whole lot like on, a whole lot like the old-fashioned hay carriers in the barns. Tracks and stuff. It worked similar to those. Although on those, the hay goes clear up to the car and locks there and then goes back in the barn. Whereas with the high lines, as they call it, they don't never go clear up. Very seldom go clear up logs. They'll dangle the ends with the chokers or the cables around them that's fastened to this. Will go up in the air high enough that that way it takes them over windfalls and holes and everything. But the other end of them usually touches the ground. It'll bounce along. And if they go across a little draw, why, even the other end will leave sometimes. But those are cut into logs, short logs. They're not for tree lengths. And they bring them in, and then they got to using horses back there to drag some of them down to where this high line could reach them. They can't reach out like they do when they change lines. And that they logged that way quite a while. They have some high lines, maybe, and some ground line donkeys in the camp. Then they had some small rigs, slides they called them, I believe. It had a small end. They looked like a donkey engine, an upright engine on them, and they'd have a short line. I don't remember how far out they'd go. They generally wouldn't go over. I don't think. They could go out quite a way, but I did load most of the log just around 100 or 2 feet from the track. And they could put them on pretty cheap that way because it didn't take a minute to do it, you see, and let the big outfits, you know, that's too close for them to work on them anyway. They used that method. And then they did use caterpillars for a while. They had one camp up here not far from where I live that was all caterpillars. I scaled for that too when I was scaling. That's not the same time the others, of course, at Bova, but I scaled for it down here toward home, and they began logging this part of the country. And then a little later, they went on with the cats and horses. They got into horses then, horses skidding short logs. And they hauled them in on what they called a boomer. It was like if you saw two blocks off a fairly large round log. And then they drill a hole through the center and put them on an axle. And these two big blocks, they use them for wheels. And then they'd have a bunk across. They call their timber reach from one to the other. They'd put these logs in them up on them just like they did the go devils on this logging on snow and chain them there and their back ends drag on the ground, and that's what they hauled in. They were a funny looking thing and pretty clumsy, but that's the way they've done most of their logging. Unless it was right close, then they might just skid in the tongs. Then they logged with that for a long time. They did that pretty much. Well, I started to see until I retired. Not quite, because they got to going into the trucks then, finally, like they logged today. And they got to using them quite a little bit. And they found out they don't have to run this track in. They don't have to fool with the donkeys and all those things. And they can let the contract out to the men and let them worry about their trucks and everything. And so they started logging with them. And this man, Kildy, that I said was a check scaler, he and I, we scaled down here at the Potlatch Dam for the first summer that they logged with these trucks and logged down there. But then I quit because I could no longer get work only just in the summer. That's the only time they could use those outfits, and they'd shut down things, and I couldn't work. And then they began to go into the trucks, and I started in, I worked at Carpenter work for a little bit until the mail route opened up. But so that was the last I did the logging. But now then, of course, it's all did with big logging trucks every place. They haul them for miles and miles.
You scaled and you clerked for one camp, right?
Well, I clerked for scaler, clerked for two or three camps at different times.
But it was one camp at
one
a time.
One at a time. Well, now I scaled for two camps down here at home, because a while there I had one camp, and then, I was part of it. There's two of us scalers there at that time. I scaled for part of it, and then I scaled for this caterpillar camp over here, too, for a while. But
was your family living down here while you were working up there?
My family always lived down here all the time.
So you just got back down to see them occasionally.
That's right. I didn't get down very often now, I'll tell you. I got down, my brother-in-law worked up there. He had a car and I didn't. We usually come down on a weekend. We'd come down and we didn't have very long weekends, you know. We'd have to